As we explained to you last week, one of our gravest difficulties in studies of this kind is a confusion of terminology. Because in the course of man's philosophical and religious history, many schools have arisen which devised systems essentially very similar, but in detail often confused by arbitrary definitions of specific terms. So we will begin this evening by trying to clarify some of these problems as they relate to the bodies and constitution of man. We begin with those schools which have naturally and instinctively divided the compound nature of the human being into three parts. These three parts are referred to as spirit, soul, and body, or sometimes spirit, mind, and body. Under this rather general division, the human being is simply defined as existing with a spiritual ends or principle, a plus, usually represented by the term spirit, a negative or minus represented by the term body. And between these two extremes, a composite, complex structure of invisible energies, forces, and powers, which are all grouped together under the single term soul. Such a classification has more or less dominated Western thinking, and as a result, soul has come in theology to simply represent all the invisible parts of man except the divine spirit, which is at the source of his existence. This definition, incidentally, has strangely carried over into modern psychology, which perhaps unwittingly has borrowed the most prevalent theological concept. Thus, for psychology, man has a body and an invisible compound constitution termed his psyche. And beyond that, if the psychologist is an outstanding idealist, he may affirm the existence of this X or unknown quantity, a spiritual principle or energy. As to the nature of man's subjective constitution, the invisible parts of himself, these are assumed by modern psychology to be one essential structure, divisible certainly into parts and levels, but all actually of one essential design, constitution or pattern, and therefore subject to therapy or analysis as a unit. Such analysis as might be bestowed upon one part of this psyche would therefore be applicable to another. And in the search for man's invisible constitution, it has been considered sufficient to assume that this one constitution is a single organ or organization of some kind. Now, other schools, we are thinking for the moment of some of the old Hermetic philosophers, analyzed and arranged the bodies of man according to the four elements, assigning to fire, spirit, to mind, or to air, mind, to water, soul, to earth, body. Now, some of the alchemists went further and announced the existence of a fifth element, which they called Azoth, and which they likened to an intangible spiritual ether, the energy or vitality of space. When they gave this fifth element to their pattern, they placed it at the top, causing it to be analogous to spirit. Then they further distinguished the vehicles as air, representing now mind, fire, representing emotion, water representing the etheric or vital body, and earth representing the corporeal body. Now this division is essentially that which we find in the writings of the German mystic Jakob Däniken, and it occurs in a large number of the medieval systems, particularly those that came under the influence of the early Christian and Muslim mystics. Now in the East, and in some other groups, particularly the Egyptian, the septenary division of man was recognized. Man was therefore composed of seven principles. Under such, in the Hindu system, we find the first or highest of these defined as Atma. Atma was the spiritual root, equivalent to our term spirit. They then considered the second of these planes to be called Buddhi, which was the sphere of universal cognition. This was their second world. They then took what is called the Manasa field, and they divided it into the Rupa and Arupa Manas, or the higher and lower, or the lower and higher in that order, aspects of mind, which gave them four divisions. They followed this by the two divisions of Kama, which we referred to last week as Devakan and Jamaloka. They then went to the, which gave them six principles. They then descended to the etheric field and named the vital principle, or vital body, which gave them the seven. They never considered the body as a principle. It was always a vehicle or dehan or container of principles. This septenary division also arises among the Gnostics, and we learn that we have traces of it in Neoplatonism in the visions and symbols of Plotinus and Proclus. Thus, you see, we have quite a confused picture. Yet this confusion is rather in the arrangement of a pattern rather than in any definite difference in the principles involved. It depends entirely upon the term, the school, and the group to which you belong as to how you wish to classify these different vehicles or sections of man's constitution. Tonight we want to compare the departments of the mental body, and we want to ask why in the Hindu system the mind was considered as totally and completely separate from the emotions, entirely contrary to Western psychology. The reason being to the ancient Hindus, as we know, that through their personal examination of the extrasensory perceptions, by extrasensory perceptions, they learned that the vortices, or centers of energy, in the mental and emotional fields went in opposite directions. Therefore, these could not be merely conditions of each other. They had to represent purely and completely separate vehicles of manifestation. To this consideration, they also added the basic purpose or energy pattern behind the two fields. Essentially, the field of Kama, or desire, is fulfilled through the purification of desire and its transmutation into the principle of pure love. The regeneration and redemption of the mental body consisted in its transmutation from thought and opinion and sense to the substance of pure reason. Now, the difference between love and reason may be difficult to define, but it is essentially valid. And we recognize this in the difference between intellectualism and emotionalism as these two forces operate in our daily lives. The principle of emotion is moved on the foundation of desire. The principle of reason is moved on the foundation of research, or the search for insight. The end of reason is the possession of fact. The end of emotion is to be possessed by the object of desire. These differences the Muslim mystics very quickly differentiated, and they realized that while these two vehicles are seldom to be examined separately, and cannot be considered as having a separate existence during physical life, that they do represent two principles in the structure of man, and that these two principles have different essential destinies to fulfill. Also, that the mental body was individualized in man, whereas it is not individualized in the animal. If the two were merely parts of one body, then we would be justified in the Darwinian concept that man is merely the most intelligent of the animals. The Hindus will not accept that. They do not believe that man and the animal are identical creations, of which one has advanced more than the other. They insist that this differentiation occurred archetypally, and that the human species is not merely an outgrowth of the animal kingdom, although Indian philosophy will not deny that the physical bodies of man have an animal origin. Man became man when a rational principle was introduced by the Lords of Mind, and this introduction sets man apart. This is implied by the very term man himself, for this is one of the many English words that have a curious root and affinity in Eastern languages. It is interesting that in Indian philosophy, Manas is the name for mind. Also that Manu was the great lawgiver. And these ideas also are carried in the concept of Manes, the famous Manichaean teacher, whose name signified the intellect of the world. Thus man's name, as man, means the thinker, means the mind born. And his cognition and his power implies in the book of Genesis that man, Manas, the Adam, was given dominion over the animals and told to bestow upon each its proper name. And he named them according to their kinds. And by naming is implied in the ancient text understanding or discovering the true and essential nature of things. And it is this discovery of the true and essential nature which is the peculiar labor of mind. In modern psychology, we know, for example, that the confusion of the emotional mental principle in diagnosis has and does lead to some very difficult and sometimes disagreeable results. If, for example, in analysis, we release more of the emotional energy or psychic libido, then the individual is able to control by mental energy. If, therefore, he is unable to rationalize the release which is made, only a Pandora's box is opened, and the patient may be in more difficulty than he was before. We must therefore recognize that the administration of man as a compound being has been vested primarily in the mental principle, and that where this principle, for any reason, is unable to function adequately, we have confusion and difficulty in the personality. Now, we also want to bear in mind that each body of man's involved chain of vehicles, each body is manifested especially and directly through the body next inferior to itself. The subtle always manifesting through the grosser never manifesting through the more subtle. It is therefore possible that in man's function, during life, the emotional principle is always seen or known with the mental energy embedded within it. In other words, the mind functions through the emotional structure. The mind cannot be discerned objectively, apart from the psychic field in which it operates. Yet it is not completely true that the mind and this psychic field are identical. But man, turning within himself, looking for mind, sees first its garment, which is the emotional body. And within this emotional body, throned in the deepest and most subtle recesses of it, the principle of mental energy. Thus it might well be termed the Merkaba of the ancient Kabbalists, the chariot of ecstasy. For it is this mysterious emotional principle, the Shekinah of the ancient Jewish law, that goes before the Lord in glory, representing the vestment, veil, or appearance through which the mental power is able to manifest or release itself. Recognizing these as essentially the teachings of certain legitimate schools, we cannot, under the limitation of time that we have, try to reconcile all of the details. But we must begin our study of the Manas principle as it applies to our major theme, which constitutes the body sequence. The mental body of man is composed of very subtle material, which has been called mentoids. They are units of mental energy, equivalent to mental molecules. And these subtle materials, like the cells of the human body, gather together on their own plane of vibration to form an extremely attenuated instrument, an instrument which in man at the present time is not completely developed, an instrument which, therefore, does not reveal nearly the integration which we find in the emotional body. The mental body is usually depicted as a kind of aureole or halo surrounding the head and shoulders, or the upper part of man. This mental body, of course, does actually permeate all parts of the physical form through extension and through the connective ethers which we have already mentioned. But in its grosser and more apparent form, still, however, very attenuated, it is recognized or known largely through this aureole of light, this haze of a golden color, which surrounds the upper part of man, and in which certain vortices or pinwheel-like cycles of moving energy may be noticed or apperceived. This mental principle, or mental body carrying the mental principle, is divisible into three parts, of which the lowest is referred to as the Kama Manas. And the Kama Manas is the mind of desire, or that part of the mental energy which, extending directly downward, becomes almost immediately involved in the kamic principle, or becomes more or less the servant of desire. Buddhism has much to tell us about this particular phenomenon. But we know that mind, in a mysterious way, as the governor, must govern three worlds, because all things exist in three primary states. Just as on the piano, we have the natural tone, and then it's sharp and it's flat. So in the case of man's mental nature, the mind natural, or the natural tone, is placed between two opposing polarities. The lower polarity extending downward into body through the kama, or desire form. The middle part remaining entirely aloof, being itself, or the pure principle of intellect. The upper part ascending upward, called the Arupa Manas, which is verging higher and towards the creativity of Buddhic intuition. Thus the mind has a considerable gamut of energies, resources, and responsibilities. And the mental body must activate and maintain all of these processes. The descent of the mind or mental body into union with Kama makes available what Buddhism would call the illusionary mind, or what would be referred to in Vedanta or perhaps Christian Science as mortal mind. It is mind moving downward into the illusion of matter. It is mind blinded like Samson and bound to the millstone of the Philistines. It is mind, called in some systems concrete mind, that type of mind which is geared to all of the objective purposes of the mortal objective nature. Therefore, the individual who has a mighty stratagem for the making of $1 million is working very hard with the principle of Kama Manas, or Kama Manas. He is objectifying the mental energy He is leading it downward into the gratification of his desire for $1 million. For that reason, mind is captured by desire and held and becomes the slave of desire and begins the long and elaborate process of trying to satisfy desire or to fulfill the innumerable insistences of the emotional nature. Emotion causes man to want something. He then never rests until by the ingenuity of the Kama Manas he is able to secure that which he desires. In this process of struggling desperately for the gratification of the sensory perceptions, we have a key to the Buddhist doctrine of the skandhas, or the links by which man is bound to an illusional existence. Kama Manas also fulfills itself in the gratification of ambition, of possession, and is the root of defense and escape reflexes within the psychic organism. One of the duties of this faithful servant of desire is to protect the very desire structure with which it has become involved. Therefore, we find in psychology, in working with those who are in psychological difficulties, a tremendous ingenuity in which the mind seems to deliberately frustrate the work of the therapist. This is because the desire continues to desire itself, demand its own fulfillment, and because it has no actual orientation on the level of what is necessary or good. Thus, in the undeveloped person to which we are referring, the Kama Manas becomes buried or absorbed or engulfed in the illusion. And in this condition, it goes on to produce the entire development of what we call an objective materialistic culture. For it is mind bound to unregenerate desire which causes materialism. It also causes the innumerable intensities of hatred, fear, suspicion, and immediately spins webs of apparent reason around these things, causing the individual to justify, to excuse, to condone, and sometimes have a quick and ready explanation for that which still remains untrue. Bound thus, linked thus with the principle of desire, mind, or the mental principle, is comparatively powerless to serve the original purpose for which it was intended. The second level of mind consists of the middle zone, for the mental body, like all of the others, is not only divided into an upper, middle, and lower part, but into a septenary, consisting of three lower levels, a central level, and three higher levels. Thus, each body becomes a microcosm or symbolic miniature of the entire structure. The mind, of course, is bound through the mental body to the brain because of the intellectual or mental ether, which is one of the four divisions of the etheric double or vital body, and it is seated within seven peculiar vortex centers within the great structure of the brain. For within the brain of man is also a complete septenary of vortices and vital points, and in this septenary the pineal gland occupies the position of the sun, forming a minute solar system around which, through the ventricular orifices, the orbits of the ancient planets move in their magnetic fields. So the principle of individuality is held to be that part of man's mind by which he is peculiarly and uniquely man. Because the Hindus and the Greeks and the Egyptians and the Chinese, and nearly everyone else for that matter, was convinced that man is not man because his thoughts are fulfilled on the level of desire. Man is primarily man because he is master of himself. And the attainment of equilibrium, the rescuing of mental energy from any purpose different from itself. It is therefore the peculiar concern of the fourth or central zone of the mental body. Here we have pure mental energy, available only when through various activities, particularly the use of the mind in the regeneration of its own structure, and its doctrinal effect on the regeneration of the emotions, and various circumstances arising from experience, and on the emotional level, religious or mystical devotion. When, from one reason or another, the emotional nature relinquishes its authority over the mind, becoming, as in the ancient scriptures, the handmaiden of the Lord, then the emotions become available as means for the fulfillment of the purposes of mind. But this is an exceedingly rare occurrence, and for all practical purposes, in the average human being, the mind principle is still under the tyranny of unregenerate desire, particularly celebrated in its most basic form, selfishness, from which man has a long way to go in the majority of cases. And so confused is his picture that one of the ways in which he is most selfish is often in his desperate effort to be unselfish. It is a very complicated and difficult substance to attain. Now, what would we say would be the nature of mind entirely apart from any involvement? Actually, probably, the nearest thing that we could say would be to give the old definition that was supposed to be on the gates of an ancient temple, namely, man, know thyself. This term is also attributed to Socrates. Therefore, essentially, the nature of mind per se is the self-knower. By the self-knower, we mean the mind's ability to examine and analyze the nature of the egoic vortex, which is located in the midst of it. Well, what man calls essential selfhood, or his existence as a sentient individual being, is posited on the fourth or central zone of the mental body, and is usually visible there as a ring of light, the mysterious ring of the Nibelungen and the ring of the gods. This ring of light represents the selfhood of man, the psychological entity or the focal point of all the attributes and attitudes and aptitudes which make up individuality. It is therefore the essential duty of the mind to analyze the nature of self. And in making this analysis, to discover that part of self which is an illusion, to discover the relationship between self and reality, and to come to the final Buddhistic conclusion that the ego, sattva, or personal self is not the reality, but actually, basically, and inevitably, as the Gita tells us, it is the slayer of the real. Thus, as one old philosopher has said, the grand purpose of the mind is the realization of disillusionment. In other words, it is the mind which finally tells us that we are not as good as we think we are and never will be. It is the mind which, at the end of knowledge, finally discovers that it knows nothing. Socrates, on one occasion, is reported to have said that he was the wisest man in Athens because he was the only man in Athens who knew that he was a fool. Now, this might sound like a symbolic exaggeration, but in principle, the point, though perhaps over-dramatized in my statement, is essentially true. Namely, that until man, by means of the mind or the intellect, recovers from the hypnosis of intellectual existence, he is going to be bound forever. If not in servitude to desire, he will be bound in servitude to egoism, which is not much better. And of all egoism or egotism, the primary impulse is the desire to exist, or the desire to be, or the desire to survive. This, then, is to Buddha the greatest of all the illusions. Now, it isn't simply that the principle of intelligence or individuality is merely to discover this negative and pathetic point about its own existence. There is more to the story than this. Actually, the individual rescues himself by discovering the fact about himself. He releases the mind from first the bondage of emotion and desire, and secondly from the autocracy of ego. Now, the mind itself has an apperceptive range, and the mental body is therefore divided into zones capable of supporting the uses of energy, just as the physical body has veins and nerves and arteries and tissues because of the various energies that are necessary to maintain it. So the mental body has various degrees of substance within it, suitable for the dissemination and distribution of the various qualities of mental energy. The point of intellection or individuality is climaxed by the individual's self-analysis and his final recognition of the incredible limitation imposed by the concept of selfhood itself. He therefore gradually gains the possibility of intellectually transcending the fact of his own individuality. Now, this may be getting a little confusing, so we'll pause and go back a little and start over again. But the image is very definite. The man who is poor goes to the motion picture, spends an evening watching the foibles of the rich, and is thereby able to imagine a state different from his own. We can, because of numerous symbols and extensions of experience around us, imagine that which we have not factually experienced. This means that by imagination we can transcend the boundaries of the known. Now, imagination is one of the contributions that the emotional nature makes to the mental problem of projection. And by means of the emotional quotient now coming to the service of the intellect instead of becoming the master of it, we have the gradual integration of what has been termed the arupa manas, or the formless or higher creative mind. Now, when we say formless, we do not mean that the structure itself is formless. We mean, rather, that it is capable of the contemplation and consideration of formless ideas. In other words, primitive man, searching for a language, first created symbolic pictures, and he could make pictures of houses and of horses and of birds. He could even draw a reasonable or unreasonable facsimile of himself. But it took a long time in the development of language before man could find hieroglyphical devices to communicate ideas. He could make a house, but he couldn't draw a picture of good. He could make a fine study of an ancient dinosaur or some other prehistoric monster on one of the cave walls in southern France. But he could not make a figure or drawing or representation of hope. Therefore, he began to work out the problem of how to do this. He had trouble with verbs also, because he was drawing pictures that did not move, representing action. The only way he could do it was to place his figures in an active posture. But action was one thing. He fought that out and came to some conclusions, but he still had a great deal to do in order to try to find out how to define pure beauty, for example. When he said, "I want a thing to be beautiful," how could he make a picture of it? Well, probably in the beginning he had that kind of egoism which caused him to draw a picture of himself and establish that as the standard of beauty. In fact, today, among a great many races and peoples. Their own racial type is the standard of beauty. But he had other problems. He could represent tangibles, but not intangibles. And his difficulty represented in very large measure the groping of his mind, moving from concrete to abstract. In order to develop beyond the point of primitive society, humanistic individual isolationism, the complete centering of energy upon self, in order to pass beyond that, man had to devise means to acquire the ability to create within himself certain patterns, symbols, or ideas which possessed creativity. Now, mind, being a single structure, basically, although divided into many parts, mind was not capable of solitary creativity. Creation is always the union of a male and female polarity. So, through the union of the mind and the emotions, creativity became possible. And the mental body, through this union, gained the power of imagination, gained the powers of certain creative abstraction, and was able to operate analytically on such subjects as desire or faith. One of the earliest productions of this type of abstraction was religion, by which man gradually came to create an invisible world. It was even more powerful and more dominant than the visible one. Yet as a being, he had never actually seen any of these things which he believed. Yet he knew with an internal certainty that they existed. Each human being in the process of growth, in the years between adolescence and maturity, recapitulates the entire cycle and must move toward individuality and through individuality to creativity. Creativity in maturity is biological, psychological, and spiritual. And if it is not all three, then it has failed to complete or perfect its own pattern. On the level of abstract mind, then, we find the gradual development of philosophies, of religions, of arts, the rise of great ethical institutions, the development of all of these dreams by which man, different from any other creature known to him, is able to long for, yearn after, and attain that which is different from his present state, and do so by his own energy. Had the animal world possessed this power, man could never have been master of the earth. If the animal had creativity on a psychic or psychological level, man could never have dominated the world. It would be the animal that would have built cities instead of man and would have defended them. But because man had this faculty, he has made himself lord of the creation that we know. Certainly, he is lord of it largely symbolically, because he actually dominates no part of it except that which is lesser than himself. Creativity, then, in the experience of the individual, produces certain changes in the structure of the mental body. We have told you that the etheric binders or bridges which unite the body objectively to the subjective superior principles behind it are two-way roads of communication and even sometimes of transportation. As surely as the mental energy flowing downward into the personality enables man to bring certain order out of chaos in his environment and gives him ultimately perhaps judgment and the ability to control through reason the excesses and intensities of his appetites. At the same time, contact with the world and with the environmental universe around him carries its own messages back into the mental nature, causing a constant enrichment or inflowing of available resources. Thus, the mind is strengthened by living, even as life is directed by the mind. And through learning and knowledge, we increase the powers of the mind, so that by training, by evolution, and by various processes, we may distinguish the gradual maturity of intellect. And according to conservative records, we say that history records, up to the present time, approximately 10,000 examples of what we might term mature mind. In other words, mind that has reached a degree in which it has no longer been forced to concern itself primarily with its own existence, but has transcended this and made creative contribution to the universal well-being of humanity. In this level, then, mind grows. The Platonic school instructed disciples, learning penetrates into various parts of the mind according to the nature of the learning. That learning, which is primarily for the maintenance of the personality, and which may be heavily catering to the selfishness of a generation or a perspective at the time, naturally strengthens the relations between manas and kama and causes gradual development of ambition motives. The mind then begins to figure how it can advance the personal life of the external individual through the use of the skill which it has gained. Therefore, we read the little ad in the paper. There's nothing wrong with the ad, but in the study of man's nature, it tells us something. Take our course and earn more money. The point is very simple. The project is to inspire skill in order that the individual may improve his material condition. The motive then belongs on the kama manas level, or the use of mind, or the improvement of mind for the fulfillment of desire. This level is not the only one upon which we function, however. And we know that there are many systems of knowledge which do emphasize the fact that by learning these things, you become a better person. This type of appeal is directed toward the fourth level, or the level of individuality. It is the seat of the intelligent principle located in the central part of the mind structure, and also the throne or immediate environment of the ego. The development then of individuality by the mind means the training of the mind for its own sake. This is like, on the physical plane, a certain type of person who gets up every morning and takes a 2-mile walk before breakfast. He is not going anywhere, and he doesn't expect to arrive anywhere except back home again, but he certainly is developing a fine physique. He is exercising the body for the sake of the body. We may meet him so often on shipboard doing the 5 turns of the deck before breakfast and waking up everyone on the ship. He is not doing this primarily because he enjoys it. He's not catering especially to kama manas. He is not doing it because actually it is going to serve anybody else. It is only going to disturb them. Therefore, he is not doing it for the sake of universal good. He is doing it because he regards it as a healthful exercise, or exercise for the sake of exercise. In the mind, we have the same type of problem, and when this is clearly defined, we have what we commonly term the pure intellectual. He is the individual who learns from the love of learning, who enjoys new ideas for their own sake primarily, and whose life is best satisfied in the adventure of extending his mind into the unknown, not because he even expects to use what he learns for himself primarily, simply because he is an adventurer on a mental level. He lives to use the faculties that he has and rejoices in the fact that he possesses them. On an intellectual level also, these are the persons who very often become what has been called by David Starr Jordan, the impotent intellectual. He is the individual who knows a great deal but does nothing. He is the English teacher who can use every word in the language effectively but has nothing to say. He is the individual who has a magnificent instrument which he has polished and perfected, but has not really learned any reason for having the instrument. It is simply wonderful and beautiful because it is his. Or the accumulator, who gathers all kinds of things he does not want and does not need, simply because of the joy of gathering them, finding them, and knowing that he has them. This intellectual person is more or less of a discouragement to those around him, because he is completely satisfied to think. He finds his life as full of thinking as other people find it full of thoughtlessness. He is very much like the person who lives only to gratify his desires. It's a one-pointed program. And whether we're satisfying our love of thought or satisfying our appetites, the satisfaction represents a use which in itself is neutral. And being neutral is the weakest of all applications, because it reminds us of that famous statement of what the Lord does to those who are neither hot nor cold. The mind, however, has above this level a further gamut of extension upward into what has been sometimes called the buddhi manas, or the arupa. That is, this motion into the world of idea ideal. The mind gradually reaches the point in its ascent through the structure of its own nature, in which its own reflections can no longer be held within the bounds of the mediocre. The mind cannot be stopped in growing. And as it grows out of its appetitive attachments into those of pure intellect, which may be termed essential scholarship and has many parallels to what we call the exact sciences, it then proceeds onward to the development of bridges of consciousness between itself and that which is next superior to itself. The very study of our world by a materialist will ultimately make an idealist out of him, no matter how hard he tries to prevent it. We will refuse to accept a negative statement on this, because while it may not be accomplished in one life, and it might take him 25 lives to do it, any individual who is essentially a sincere scholar will ultimately become an idealist. He can't help it, because he can't stop himself. He can block himself through the period of a lifetime by closing his mind. He can frustrate the very motion of growth within him by taking a highly reactionary position and forcing this upon his own nature. But he cannot keep it up, because the pressure of growth, like the pressure of the little root between the rocks, will ultimately break the stone. Nothing can prevent growth. So the very development of mind itself means inevitably that mind must escape from the obvious and begin the contemplation of that which is not obvious. The mind is so endowed that having established a certain point, it must adventure forth from that point, not only downward into lesser things, but upward into greater things. And by degrees, the intellectual moves toward philosophy. He moves towards the rationalization of the universe. He moves from the realm of thought to the realm of idea. And as he does so, he gradually gains familiarity with this sphere and discovers that ideas are a wonderful, flexible material which can be molded, and that he is living, possessing within himself faculties by which he can apperceptively know more than the mind can actually rationally reveal to him. So rationality, which we like to consider to be the highest attribute of the mind, is that level which has accepted the reasonableness of certain things that cannot be immediately perceived. Rationality is orientation in a world of reason, whereas intellect is merely orientation in a world of facts. Man, having attained rationality, for example, recovers from the diseases that come from the absence of this quality. We are reminded of Bacon's famous definition of atheism. A little learning inclineth the mind to atheism, but greatness of learning bringeth the mind back again to God. Thus reason can accept God when intellect cannot. But in the process of achieving this, reason has rescued God from the thought forms imposed upon it by intellect. Thus, reason is forever justifying itself by redeeming false concepts about things presumably known or believed. When we come upon an idea superior to what we have, we may say that it is reasonable because it does not break the essential pattern of conviction but extends beyond the obvious. Reason, then, in the apperceptive power of the mind, is that phase of the mind which is gradually orienting the individual in a universal existence rather than in a personal existence. We've already said that man has three possible orientations: personal, objective; individual, subjective; universal, spiritual. And in these orientations, the purpose of reason is to move the mind gradually from the individual toward the universal. Now we might say that this then indicates that the mind may be considered synonymous with the buddhi, which we will describe or discuss next week, and that the mind by extension can attain a universal state. Actually, this is not true, because the mind cannot transcend the boundaries and limitations imposed by the vibratory substance of which it is composed. And the mind cannot transcend the process of ratiocination. It cannot transcend the process of thinking. It can work that process over. It can attenuate it and refine it to almost inconceivable degrees. But the mind is the thinker. And the mind cannot survive the state of the suspension of thought. The thought process, when exhausted, brings with its termination the end of the mental existence. We sometimes use the analogy that is found in the Pentateuch relating to this. For we know that Moses, who represents the elder mind of Israel, was permitted to see the promised land, but he could not enter, and was required to go to sleep in the hills of Moab. And Jehoshua, the son of Nun, led the children of Israel into the land of Canaan. Moses, the great lawgiver, the great teacher, the symbol, perhaps, of the great philosopher of Israel, could not enter into the promised land, which was symbolically the Sabbath of the Lord. He could not go in, because the mind cannot enter a state essentially superior to itself. Therefore, at the gates of a superior state, the mind must go to sleep and be gathered to its fathers. So man's mind, this upper gamut, which we call the arupa manas, is the gradually rising levels or zones of mental refinement that lead gradually from the first simple appreciation of finer things until the individual says, as Mohammed is supposed to have said, "Had I two coats, I would sell one and buy white hyacinths for my soul." When man reaches this point, he is beginning to escape from the tyranny of collective mind or material mind. Other things are becoming more important to him. There has been a union between the refining and unfolding emotions and the mental principle. And from this union is being born the beautiful. That which dedicates its energies and resources to these things which have inward and eternal significance. Also, we find that this type of mind begins to be more concerned with quality than with quantity, more concerned with attainment of value than recognition by others, and ever more dedicated to those principles which, invisible and unknown to the majority, are still gradually unfolding within that being and becoming the most necessary things in the world of that being.